System on RadioArea.com.
I'd like to put on now Steve Frost, who's going to talk about the relationship between the Green Movement and National Socialism. So thank you, Steve. Thanks.
Good afternoon. What I plan to do, without turning this into a history lecture, is to try and put some bones on one of my pet subjects, which is environmental concerns. And I'm going to look at it in terms of the history of green politics in this country and in Western Europe. I'm not looking at the United States and Canada, I'm leaving that entirely alone. But the crux of my argument is that in modern times, particularly in the last 25, 30 years, green politics has very much become the preserve of the political left. In fact, so far to the left, you've got the sort of crusty activists over there, the anarchists, the anarchos, the ELF, you know, Environmental Liberation Front, these sorts of people who are dyed in the wool far to the left. And most of those who write articles and campaign on behalf of the environment, which is a very, very broad area of politics and social politics, is all from the left. The entire perspective is from the left. And what they won't accept is that the bare roots of environmental politics are actually rooted within nationalism and a good part of it in National Socialism. And I think it's high time that the movement in its broadest sense, I'm not just talking about the National Socialist movement, where I'm coming from, in the broadest sense, we should be looking at the whole question of green politics and reclaiming those elements of it where we can, and to take it back from the left and to start to put blood and soil back into what is essentially blood and soil politics. Most of those who write about it, as I say, are either from the left or from social democratic political position. And what they will not accept is that there is anything worthwhile within racial nationalism or national socialism in terms of eco-politics. I mean, there are some, particularly if you get translations of some of continental Europe's papers and publications, where they talk about eco-fascism. That's what they accuse anybody who has a nationalist perspective on environmental politics. It's eco-fascism and must be avoided at all cost. And they ignore, by and large, one of the most glaring subjects, which is immigration and population shift. If there is one thing that they will, you know, step way apart from, not to draw attention to, is this inpouring of humanity into Western Europe and into the United Kingdom from the Third World, and the impact it will have on the environment, that is something they don't want to talk about. In fact, there is only one body outside our field of politics that bothers to address it all, and that is Population Matters, if anybody's ever come across it, which has a website and publishes a magazine and is supported by people like Sir David Attenborough. But they are concerned with the whole global population issue and its impact on the world environment. But at least they're honest enough to say that immigration and mass immigration and mass migration is a major problem. What these people will not recognise is the impact it has on ourselves in the United Kingdom, with an inpouring of people from countries and cultures who have absolutely no interest in our natural environment at all. They have no affinity with our natural environment, and therefore it's open to be trashed as far as they're concerned. From all kinds of perspectives. From at the bottom end, the Pakistani landlord who guts some houses and sees no problem in then fly-tipping all the rubbish that he's collected in a country lane, to the multi-billionaire George Soros and the like, who look at flat green fields and woodland and hedges and think, major housing development, rip it all up, annihilate the biodiversity in there, let's concrete it over and build some executive residences en masse. Because they've got no affinity with it. Whereas the people who live here, who have been here for generations, we have a blood and soil tie. The sweat and the blood of our ancestors is within that soil. The bones of our ancestors are within that soil. And prior to the Industrial Revolution, we were tied to it. We were very much part of it. My interest, personal interest, in this whole question came with one or two things that popped up when I first got involved with politics. And you found little snippets in strange magazines which would say things like, did you know that the first country to outlaw gin traps and illegal snares was National Socialist German? What?
And honey.
Did you know that the Central European forests were safe from destruction by Hermann Göring? Hmm? And you start to think, never heard of that, never heard of that. Nobody publicises these things. And I started to delve into a little bit more. And then I was a mature undergraduate student at Warwick University, and somebody drew my attention to this. It was an article that appeared in History Today in September 1984. By Dr. Anna Bramwell, and it was entitled, Was This Man the Father of the Greens? And I looked at it, and I thought, that's Walter Dare, in an Allgemeine SS uniform. And Walter Dare, I knew very little about, other than who he was, and I read her article, and I was fascinated. And when her book came out, as it came out later, about the whole blood and soil, Walter Dare and Hitler's Green Party at the end of the 1980s, I was astounded. Because here was somebody who was taking a factual look at green politics and National Socialism and coming up with a tremendous view of history that had been kept hidden. And she quite rightly pointed out that if you wanted to know about green politics and what's loosely termed the far right, you would find very little to read. There was a book produced, I think it was in the 1970s, in English, post-war history, by J.E. Farquharson, called The Plough and the Swastika, which is a very, very dry book. If you like to read facts and figures about grain production in 1934, and, you know, turnips and Swedes being harvested near Goslar, in Thuringia, then that's for you. But to actually find anything of real interest, it's very, very different. It's very difficult indeed. But what one thing Bramwell came out with, which was fascinating, was that much of the language in the post-war environmental movements, particularly from Western Europe, but also in this country, and in, say, in Australia and in the United States, a lot of the expressions they were using about biodiversity and biomass and species diversity, and species rich. These were all expressions which were appearing in publications in the 1920s and 1930s, almost, but not entirely, exclusively in German. Or in Dutch. And I thought, there's something really in this. And so, I read Bramwell's book, cover to cover, and I started to delve into some of the sources she was quoting. And I discovered that here in this country, we have a very strong tradition aligning our version, our world view of politics, with environmental politics. And it astounded me, springing out from the end of the 19th century, you know, the established historians and writers, don't like to mention this too much, J.R.R. Tolkien was very much a Nordicist, as it was known at the time, the fashionable expression was a Nordicist, but also other writers like C.S. Lewis, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, the Chronicles of Narnia. He was a Nordicist. William Morris, who the left have long since claimed as one of the founding fathers of the Labour Party in the late 19th century, I actually managed to get hold of two books written by William Morris. They were published in the United States as reprints, but there were two. The Roots of the Mountain and The House of the Wolfings, which are, if you like, a watered-down version of Beowulf or The Lord of the Rings, but they are pure Nordic Germanic folk tales. And they were written by this man who was supposedly the heart and soul of the early Labour Party. The fact that he had one or two anti-Semitic things to say in his life and was not, you know, typical man of the late 19th century, believed the coloured races had their place, that's all swept aside. You know, William Morris is this icon of the Labour movement. I'm afraid William Morris had a strong touch of nationalism about him, which they try not to mention. And in later years, I met somebody in continental Europe who, much to my surprise, was a real champion of environmental politics. And that was Florentine Van Toningen. The late Florentine Van Toningen, I knew very well, and spent a lot of time in her company over in the Netherlands. And we got talking, purely by accident, instead of talking about modern national socialism and the need to do this and the need to do that, we found we'd got a kindred spirit there. Both had a keen interest in green politics. And she astounded me by, she turned around and she says, well, before I was married, in the 1930s, she said, I studied biology under Konrad Lorenz. What? One of the great founding fathers of 20th century European biology, she'd studied under him. And I know post-1945, Konrad Lorenz took a great deal of flack from the newly aspiring left-wing academia, because he'd got some very unsavoury ideas about race and genetics, things which after 1945 were strictly forbidden. But she studied under Lorenz. And she pointed out to me that within the Dutch National Socialist Movement, the NSB, there was a very strong environmental and focused movement. And this is the thing that we should be looking at. This is what, as a broader movement in this country, we should be embracing. It's not just one narrow thing. It's not about tree-hugging and chaining yourself to stop them fracking in some corner of Sussex. It's a far broader picture that embraces what was in Europe classed as peasant politics, folk history, folk law, folk music, the countryside, knowledge of nature, all these things all came together in the early 20th century with the Nordicists and the agrarianists, who were looking at a revolt against the Industrial Revolution. They didn't like the big urban centres, which they saw as cosmopolitan. And the driving force behind polluting the rivers and the air and churning out these huge factories that were destroying the countryside, they saw the finance that was being driven by certain groups of rootless cosmopolitans who had no sense of identification with the land that they were despoiling. And lo and behold, as I dug into it more, I sat down one afternoon with Colin Jordan and had a long discussion about green politics. And a lot of people may not know this, but Colin Jordan had a real love of nature. He loved the mountains. Since his student days, he'd been hiking and walking in the Scottish Highlands and Islands. He was very much into some of the fringe aspects of green politics. Herbal cures, natural remedies. Colin used to consume masses of cloves of garlic because he believed it was good for him. But he explored all those elements because he said that, in his opinion, you cannot divorce blood and soil and environmental issues from the threat to the human food chain from the massive agrochemical cultures and the pharmaceutical giants. He said that's all part of it. He said you have to look at the whole picture. And we had some very interesting talks about green issues and the environmental protection and how it dovetailed in with our politics. And it was at his house I came across a book. Now, people of my generation, ex-grammar school boy, one of the books you have thrust upon you in your English lessons was Tarka the Otter. I don't know how many others suffered Tarka the Otter, but it was a very much bolderized version. Bang! Tarka the Otter, that's a nice nature story, and you all felt it was a little bit sappy because it's Tarka the Otter, and they made some 1960s black and white film with various actors of the day in it. And I didn't realise that Henry Williamson, who wrote Tarka the Otter, had been an active black shirt in Sir Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists. It came as a real, you know, bolt of lightning to me, if you like, flash, if you like. And I actually got hold of one of his books, The Story of a Norfolk Farm. Now, the version I got hold of was published in 1940. I dare suggest, if you contact the Henry Williams Society today, or try and get hold of his books, it will not have the frontist statements in that this version had. Because he put two quotations in at the front. One at the top, from a publication called British Everyman in 1936. But below it, a much bigger quote, by a peer of the realm, a certain Sir Oswald Mosley. And he said, "We count it a privilege to live in an age when England demands that great things shall be done. A privilege to be of the generation which learns to say what we can give instead of what we can take. For thus our generation learns there are greater things than slothful ease, greater things than safety, more terrible things than death." And that was part of a speech that Mosley made in 1936. And in this edition, which was coming out late 39, early 1940, in fact, the footnote here was for 11th of November 1940, that Henry Williams said, much to his regret, as this particular print run went in, the publishers demanded that certain sections were taken out. And certain passages, indeed an entire chapter, were withdrawn from the book because within it he referred to the politics that were taking place in Germany in a favourable light. He also opposed the coming war because he'd served in the trenches and was a pacifist. And because he praised the work of Walter Dowry. And, of course, Henry Wilson got into all kinds of trouble. Post-1945, a lot of his books were shunned, apart from Tarka the Otter. And, in fact, in his old age, he appeared at a lecture at somewhere like Hay-on-Wye, I think it was. And while he was giving a lecture on peace politics, because he was very much involved in no more future wars, he was heckled by a group of long-haired left-wing students who were shouting fascist at him, which was nothing to do with what he was talking about. But Williamson was not the only member of the British Union of Fascists who was involved in environmental politics. Jorian Jenks was Mosley's premier spokesman on green issues and the environment. And Jorian Jenks was one of the founding fathers of the Soil Association in this country. They like to keep that quiet. Also, a gentleman in Dorset, Rolf Gardiner, very strange chap. Rolf Gardiner, massively involved in environment, organic farming, Soil Association, claimed to be a great English landowner. The fact that his mother was Swiss, I think he was Swiss and half Jewish, very strange chap, corresponded with Walter Dowry throughout the 1930s, translating German environmental literature into English for circulation in the BUF, and post-war. When Dowry was released from prison in the late 1940s and was trying to kickstart green politics in Germany, which he was struggling against the Allied occupation authorities, Rolf Gardiner was writing to him from Dorset, offering all his support and wanting articles written by Dowry to be published in this country. So there was a strong underpinning of our kind of politics within the environmental. And it's very sad that the left have been able to capture that ground to mask away the contribution of nationalists, national socialists to that argument, and to claim it for their own. Because I think there is a great deal that we could campaign on. In the modern situation, we have huge international corporate bodies which are threatening our environment. We have huge, almost industrial level farms in the east of this country, in East Anglia, Lincolnshire, further to the south, that are coming on the market. These are the sorts of open prairie farms that have destroyed the hedgerows and mass production of wheat, mass production of root crops and so on. When they come onto the market, they are being offered to Chinese business interests. Shanghai and Hong Kong is where these farms have been advertised. Can you imagine what sort of interest Chinese-based multinationals are going to show in preserving our environment, our waterways, the pollution of the land? It's going to be seen just as some sort of factory. Likewise, areas of forestry. Large areas of forestry, we wonder about this country. What a wonderful country we've got. Look how green and lush it is. Especially if you go into the Highlands of Scotland. The percentage of people who own that land aren't British. There are all manner of business interests who've invested in it and have absolutely no concern at all for the ties of local people to it, for what the people of this country actually value in that land. And these are things that we should be campaigning on. These are things that our side of politics, the broader movement, we should be looking at. We should be opposing mass foreign purchase of forestry, wholesale selling off of British farms to the Chinese. Why should it be that our heritage, because it is our heritage, our natural diversity, should be like any other commodity on an international market to people who just don't care? And as I said earlier on, the smaller scale of it, I came across two instances which summed it up for me when I was involved in countryside management. One of them was in this area, very relevant to anybody who's from the heavy woolen, like yourself, Steve. In Dewsbury, the Environment Agency was looking to clean up the rivers and the canals because they'd gone into a terrible state. This is about 10-15 years ago. They needed a major program to clear pollution and fly tipping and dumping into the water. So some bright spark said, this needs to be a multicultural approach. We need to put some money into the South Asian communities to find out what they really want from the waterways and the canals. You can imagine the conversations that were going on and the earnest voices there. We need to reach out. This is a challenge. We need to understand the tensions between our minority communities and our waterways. We need to understand how it's done. Let's have a chat with the imams. Let's get the imams together. So they organised it and they got some interpreters in because for some reason, these imams and community leaders, being here 20, 25, 30 years, don't always speak English. Don't need to if you're in Saddletown, obviously, or Ballycar. But they brought these people together. And they threw some money at it, which drew even more in. And a number of Pakistani and Bengali councillors came along, because there was free lunches and so on. Not that I'm suggesting that they wouldn't have turned up, matters of social concern, if there hadn't been a free lunch. And the environmentalists who were involved with this came away, and I was at a meeting much later when they relayed their report, and they were completely devastated by some of the things that they were told. Rather than valuing the River Calder as it sweeps through Dewsbury, or the canal as it winds its way to the moorings in Savile Basin, these people regarded it as just a very convenient place to dump rubbish. And there was a real, if you like, divide between what the women of these communities saw, as reported, and what the men saw. The men regarded it as a problem. Didn't see any need for the canals. Why would you want to float about on boats? Why do you need the basin down there at Saddletown? Concrete it over and let's park on it, make some use of it. And why not use it for tipping? We've got all this rubbish. We don't want these old mattresses and what have you. So why not lob them in? These places are dangerous. They'll be less dangerous if we fill them up and they're only shallow because there's old mattresses and furniture in. Not a problem. The women were absolutely terrified of the water. The river and the canal were a real threat to their children. They were very, very dangerous places because children could fall in and drown. Therefore, as with their husbands were quite right, fill them in. If you've got lots of rubbish piling up at the back of your house, old furniture and so on, mattresses, tip it in. Why not? It's convenient. It's just down the road. We don't have to get the cows around. And back in Pakistan, back in Bangladesh, back in South India, if you have a problem with rubbish, you just take it to the edge of the village and chuck it. It'll rot down eventually. What if it takes 50, 60 years to rust away or rot down? And they were horrified. Can't you see there's something to embrace here? Absolutely not. Plus, there's all sorts of horrible living things in it. You can't eat the fish. And there are birds and nasty biting insects. Oh no, fill them in. Get rid of them. So, this was a real shock. Meanwhile, between Cleckheaton and Huddersfield, and Heckmondwike, should I say, another green project was underway, with the local authority throwing a lot of money at it, and a national body throwing a lot of money at it, to clean up and create a new green space cycleway that would run all the way to the heart of Bradford, and all the way down to Dewsbury and eventually to Wakefield. A greenway, with national cycling organisations involved, tremendous amounts of money being put into it. There's one problem. A big section of it runs through an ethnic minority community area of Heckmondwike. We'll explain to all these people. We'll get lots of leaflets, expensively printed in Gujarati and Urdu, and circulate them around the mosques and community centres, and get everybody on board to the big clear-up that's going on and this wonderful green corridor that's going through. Once they take ownership of it, notice the Blair speak here, they take ownership of these issues, they'll be on board, and before you know it, we'll have dozens and dozens of Urdu and Gujarati-speaking environmentalists pouring in to help. Well, didn't happen. Didn't happen. They flooded these places with the leaflets, and a lot of money was spent on bringing in JCBs and 20-ton bucket wagons to clear out decades of rubbish. Old cars, burned-out motorbikes, bedsteads, you name it. Great long swathe of it through this minority area of Heckmondwike was cleared out. And one of the chaps who was in charge invited me down to have a look. Nothing political about this. This was to do the job I had at the time. And we walked through. And it was amazing. He said, we've had 60 wagons through here. 60 20-tonner loads of tipped rubbish going back decades. We've cleared the lot. We're going to tree all this. We're going to plant all this. We're going to sow wildflower seeds. It's going to be marvellous. We're striding along. I'm really impressed. Really impressed. They've cleaned it up. 19th century stonework that hasn't been seen for years. It's pristine. Marvellous. The guys who've been involved in it, they've been at it for months. It was wonderful. We came under a great old railway arch, all cleaned up, Yorkshire stone, all sandblasted. Turned the corner, and there, first thing that sees us is a great pile of fresh fly tipping. Big cardboard box, about yay big, with polystyrene wadding. It housed some sort of enormous flat screen television, latest thing. Boom, down it is. There's all sorts of other cardboard boxes and paint tins, and somebody's obviously been refurbishing their house and has launched it. And judging by the dribbles of paint and plaster dust and all the rest of it, It had come over the wall from rather a large multi-occupancy house just at the top of the rise. And the chap I'm with, he was an ex-Labour councillor, his jaw just about hit the floor. And his eyes were... And I said, oops, somebody didn't get the message. And he just blurted it out. But we've been round all the mosques, all the madrasas, all the community centres, we've talked to everybody and asked them not to do this. And I said to him, oh, so the people are Asian that have done this. He says, well, of course they have, the locals wouldn't have done it. And I thought, ooh, is this Labour Party racism rising to the top? And it turned out, yes it was. They sent the local council enforcement people round knocking on the door. And of course the people that came to the door didn't speak English. Or claim not to speak English, and couldn't understand it. No, they hadn't done it. Of course it wasn't them. You know, would they do such a thing? Well, all the dust, all the paint, all the plaster, all the rubbish, it actually comes out of your yard, over the wall, and down the slope. And of course, they decided not to find them. They let them off, sent a council, you know, an expensive council crew to clean it all up. But it makes the point. These people do not value our green spaces. Depending who you talk to. If you talk to some access manager or local authority chap who's responsible for such things, they'll say, oh, you're desperately trying to engage these people. Get them interested. The only reason that they're not interested in the countryside, not interested in the environment issue, is because they've never been approached. Yet when you talk to the people on the ground who clear away the fly tipping and the burned out cars and so on, they'll turn around and say, well, what do you expect? They couldn't care less. They don't value it. They're not interested in it. As far as they're concerned, it's our countryside. They don't care. He said, go anywhere where gangs of young Asian guys park their cars on the night. He says, the following morning, it will be strewn with polystyrene fast food wrappers, empty drink cans, you name it. It'll just be... He says, they don't care. And yet, he said, you'll get some little old deer, some old age pensioner, who will come up with a carrier bag or a bin liner and be picking it up because she cares. And that's the whole point. There is, within our own people, an innate concern for our countryside and our natural spaces. Because the ties, whether they realise it or not, blood and soil are there. And I believe, as I said at the beginning, that it is an area of political campaigning that I think we've overlooked and that I think we should go back to. That when there are serious environmental issues, in the broadest sense, I'm not talking about being tree huggers here, things that matter to the folk, local traditions, green spaces, things that matter, we should be getting involved. And don't just leave it to the well-meaning, you know, brown rice-eating, guardian-clutching leftists to take charge of it. There is, as I've said, a very strong root in environmental politics within our movement that goes back to before the 1920s, and we should look back to that, build back on it, and reclaim our place in green politics. Thank you very much.
Hold on, Steve, I've got comments.
Go on, then. Take any comments you like.
Right, two things. First of all, I would strongly recommend to you and to everyone here a page on the heretical site called Jewish Environmentalism.
Yeah.
And this is an account, it relates to the American situation, but basically it's an account of how the Jews totally subverted the environmental movement in America.
As I said, I wasn't mentioning the United States experience in what I was talking about, but I wouldn't disagree with you.
It's an object lesson for how they've got to the situation, which you correctly point out, of how the environmental movement totally ignores mass immigration. What happened, for example, just as one example, there's another, but I can't remember the details, where a Jewish businessman paid a leading environmental group in America over $1 million on condition that they didn't mention immigration.
It's the taboo subject.
Yes,
it's the taboo subject.
By means of donations and other means, they totally steered the environmental movement away from anything to do with race or immigration.
This has happened in Europe as well. I mean, we're not alone in this country in having a problem with immigration and what these migrants are doing. Certainly within Italian politics, since 1945, there's been a very strong nationalist interest in green politics, which was reflected in this country. I should have mentioned earlier on that not exclusively ourselves, but Rising, the international third position in the 1980s and 90s, was very much concerned with environmental politics, which of course tied into people like Roberto Fiore and what was going on in Italy. And there they have had problems in the area around Rome and other major cities, Milan, where huge squatter camps have been built up. Some of them are built up by African migrants, some of them are by Slovenian and Slovak Roma who've drifted over the border into Italy and set up these huge, poisonous shanty towns. I've been sent photographs on the internet by various individuals about some of these places, and these are absolutely appalling. You know, open sewers running through a shanty area, poisoning all the local waterways. You know, they'll go into a local park, slaughter all the ducks, you know, for consumption. Use the streets as an open sewer, create rubbish tubs, and obviously ignore all the laws on animal welfare and have open-air slaughterhouses that they set up, you know.
These people are subhuman. Either...
Well, they certainly lack our humanity.
They're not humane. But either someone like me, who publishes papers and contributes to human knowledge, either I'm human... If they're human, I'm superhuman. If I'm human, they're superhuman. Because the difference between these groups is just so vast. In their outlook, there's a huge contradiction there. I'm not talking about me particularly, but scientists, people who work to improve the world, to reduce suffering. But these people, they just don't care. It's just alien. It's totally alien to them. But the second point, and it's a great mystery and a bit of scuttlebutt. So you. By the time I've told you this, you will know as much as I do, and it's a mystery. Apparently, I heard this just a few days ago. There was a man on a farm who was having a private well being installed. The idea is that the firm comes in, digs a dirty great big hole, well, not big hole, but a very deep hole, until they hit the water table. And the farmer, has got his own private well, his private water supply from the water table. And he's chatting with these contractors, these workers. And one of the workers said, "You'll never guess where we're doing most of our work." He said, "No. For Muslims. A lot of the mosques are having private wells installed inside the mosque." And when I was told this, I was absolutely stunned, because I wasn't thinking about drawing the water out, I was thinking about what might be going in. But why? This is the question. Why are the Muslims digging private wells inside their mosques? Yeah. My informant is trying to find out more, because I don't know any more than that.
I would guess because they don't want to use infidel water sources from... the national network. They want to have, pure Quranic water that they have control over. No alien hand touching. Remember that they're not supposed to shake hands with infidels and things like that. There's a very strong sense in Islam of contamination from the infidels. Muslim women aren't supposed to talk to infidels. Muslim men are not supposed to shake hands with
them. When it's exposed to the water.
We are clean. Everything outside us is dirty. And that would include any nationally provided water, I imagine. It's gone through alien hands.
Cafe water, basically.
Yes, Cuffer water.
Cuffer water, yeah.
Taking up Steve's point, one thing you did mention is that possibly intensive animal husbandry, the sort of thing favoured by the global capitalist model, is of course going to run into major trouble with the resistance of many diseases among animals to antibiotics. But the trouble is that these diseases can cross over to human beings, and it's the animal sector which is likely to compromise humans rather than the other way around. But the intensive farming, of course, if that collapses, it will have a knock-on effect on agriculture and everything else, because the whole thing is a house of cards.
Absolutely. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry and agrochemicals, massive conglomerates, are tied in with food production on a huge scale, pumping the antibiotics in and meat enhancers and so on. One of the things that Colin Jordan was very interested in was avoiding mass-produced meats and so on. He was very much into organic food. And I found out that the whole question of organic vegetables and food production is not a modern concern. If you dip into what Jorian Jenks was writing in the BUF publications in the 1930s, and Rolf Gardiner, they're talking about organic food production, organic raiding of cattle. And in Germany, there was a big conference in the 1930s about this, and one of those who was a big supporter of organic foods was Rudolf Hess, which we certainly don't hear about these days. Rudolf Hess had a major interest in it, and he and Walter Dahre and I think his name was Seert, put a table of documents before Adolf Hitler to ask for a Führer decree on this, because what they didn't want to go down was the route of mass production on a factory scale, which would harm the folk. Because as they saw it, if you put lots of chemicals and artificial fertilizers out there, it would damage the blood and the soil of the nation, because they were very much tied in with the agrarianists. And they were very much arguing for, although they needed mass food production because there was a war coming, and they certainly wanted to get the very best diet for the people within the Reich, organic was the way they wanted to go. Keeping the soil rich by using natural methods and by not using, you know, synthetic fertilizers. And Rudolf Hess was part of that, putting that argument forward.
Yes. Could you tell me whether the idea of biodiversity is a positive thing to be encouraged in the sense of ethnodiversity? Was that something that was evolved in the 30s?
Yes. The whole question of natural diversity, if you like, the meadowlands that William Morris described in his writings and his paintings, those rich, if you like, pre-industrial farmland of Britain and Europe, those were, if you like, biodiverse. And Walter Dahre and people like Jorian Jenks were writing about this, because they saw it that if you start wiping out the species, you're interrupting the food chain.
But did that sense of the species include the different varieties of mankind, like ethnodiversity?
No. Ethnodiversity didn't come into it, because you'd got people involved in the Nordicists, and within that peasant politics and what have you that Dahre was exploring, like Gunther, who were arguing to keep the races separate. And you certainly did not want the situation we've got now, where unrelated third worlders are coming in.
But I've always thought that the idea of ethnodiversity was quite good, because it meant that what is being done now, the mixing of the communities, is leading to a reduction of ethnodiversity in the long term.
So correct.
You mix them. So actually, we need to keep ourselves as an ethnic group pure in order
absolutely.
To increase the world's ethnic diversity.
Absolutely. I mean, I've always had this argument with people who are very much on the green scene, that there are people who will argue till they're blue in the face about preserving the rights and the traditions of some obscure tribe in the Amazon basin. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to come here and infringe on our environment. Let them stay there. I don't like the idea of some international rubber company going in there and shooting all the indigenous peoples and then bulldozing their lands and putting rubber plantations on it, or a soya, as it is these days. Certainly not. We need to keep that diversity, the richness of humanity. What we don't want is the Kudenhof Caligari argument, where you bring everybody in and end up with one nice brown-coloured race dominating Europe that can provide cheap labour for everybody. No, I don't see biodiversity in the same light at all. The biodiversity that they were arguing for is preserving the richness of native flora and fauna and not all the introduced species. And certainly, you know, if you talk about intrusive foreign species, you only have to go down the road and there are people there, as I've already said, who don't share that love of the land that we have.
You can answer my point, Steve. About 15 years ago, the National Trust were trying to engage members of the ethnic minority communities to visit old English sites, and it flopped, it didn't take off.
Yeah.
You must have heard of that.
Yeah. The BBC has always been at the forefront of promoting ethnic minorities in the countryside and getting involved. You know, they will search far and wide to find some Indian doctor who likes walking in the Derbyshire Dales and project this out as though there's some mass interest from the minority communities. Yet one chap in a turban walking the Pennine Way does not equate to their mass sharing of it. But the BBC's been very, very, if you like, underhand and acting as a fifth column to promote that argument.
No.
Go on, Jim.
I was going to say, one of the things which connects the environmental and the political, I don't know if people read these days, a chap called Stephen Pepper, but he was a Californian philosopher back in, I think, the 40s, and he wrote a book which I recommend to everybody called something like Four Root Principles or Four Root Metaphors, and these were a sort of a tetrad of Weltanschauungen, if you like, one of which, the third one, was the organic. And basically what ties together the environmental and the human political, the folk, if you like, is the whole idea of organic growth, as opposed to, for instance, the second one of the tetrad, which was cause and effect of mechanistic engineering, which is so very typical of our socialist friends, who think that anything can be beaten, welded, hammered and machined into shape, what Kant called the crooked timber of humanity, can be re-educated to correct socialist principles by simply sort of bashing it enough. So you have a contrast between the mechanistic approach to humanity and to the environment, which is basically it's an open space for us to conquer and engineer into whatever shape we want. And you've got the let it grow organically principle, which applies both to human politics and to the environment. But the connecting root concept is organic growth as opposed to mechanistic engineering. And then there are two more, which I forget. They actually also have matching literary tropes, if you like, which Hayden White explored in Metahistory. But it's very interesting, this four principles. Each has its own language, if you like, its own metaphors. I suggest that's one way of integrating the political and the environmental. They are linked by the organic concept.
Fair enough.
So. I would just encourage people not to be put off by the Henry Williamson Society. That they don't share his views, but they make no attempt to cover them up. And his daughter-in-law, Anne, is the leading light, and she's written very extensively about his political views, and very frankly, and just says it was how it was. And they produce very high-quality material, and they produce a substantial journal every year that covers all of the different things we've been talking insofar as it relates to his books. And they go into something you mentioned briefly about hunting. Williamson had very interesting views on hunting, specifically that these cosmopolitan financial interests in the late 19th century had distorted traditional hunting practices and turned them into something that hunting never was in traditional societies. The effect that that had on management of the land and so forth. And it's in almost all of Williamson's books, and they produced a lot of excellent stuff that would inform so many of the perspectives that we've mentioned.
A certain concept of traditional hunting.
Yes, so basically in the late 19th century, Jewish financiers, not just Jewish financiers, financiers including Jews, promoted driven shooting. Whereby vast swathes of hundreds of thousands of acres are completely stripped of their flora and fauna. Mm-hmm. So hundreds of thousands of acres are stripped of their flora and fauna, so that for a few months of the year, these intensively reared game birds are then released, and you pay to shoot as many of them as you can. That was completely invented in the late 19th century and only became really popular in the early 20th century. It's a very modern thing. And this as soon as Williamson grasped this, it completely changed his attitude toward hunting, which was something he was in favour of in principle. But he became increasingly concerned that hunting had been corrupted by these cosmopolitan commercial interests.
I understand that Henry Williamson, I'm a member of the Williamson Society, and I remember he used to ride a hunting jacket to black shirt meetings sometimes. But another bit of peripheral interest is that in Lucifer Before Sunrise, he describes how during the war he goes out in defiance of the Allied effort to destroy Germany and paints a flashing circle on the farmhouse wall in which was the Mosley symbol, in which he farmed. And that still stands. You can still see traces of it if you go to Stifke or Stookie.
Yeah, in Norfolk. Yes. I do believe that he had a weathercock on his farmhouse as well, which was forged by a local blacksmith, which was, in fact, the circle and the flash as part of the weather vane that he had mounted on his farmhouse. To your point about hunting, I agree entirely, because it is a fact that driven grouse shooting in this country is a massive industry with lots of international interests. But the concerns that run it are very much corporate. I mean, it's a shame he's not here. I think David England, who was here at one of these meetings, talked about hunting as a traditional pastime. That's not a problem. If you're going to shoot and eat what you kill, that's fair enough. I mean, that is very traditional hunting. You know, the chap that goes out with his terriers and a shotgun, brings a couple of rabbits back for the pot, that's one thing. But to have some wealthy industrialist fly in, spend several thousand pounds on massacring as many red grouse as he possibly can, just to be photographed next to a pile of corpses that he's got no intention of eating, and that all the other species that might threaten that have been annihilated, and that the moors are maintained artificially. I mean, we have a big problem, I don't know how many people realise this, in this part of Yorkshire, with flooding in the winter. And one of the biggest contributors is the mismanagement of the moorland and the large landowning interests. A lot of them are not, if you like, indigenous. Work completely against the natural ground drainage to get the water off the moor as fast as possible and into the valleys, and damn the consequences for the people down below. And if these areas were managed properly and naturally, as they used to be under a traditional system, we wouldn't have half the flooding that we get. But that's back to your point about this industrialised shooting, which it is, because it's big business and it's international. And it's also in Scotland. And it's also in Scotland. If you go up some of the big estates, you try and find out who the landowners are, they're not UK registered.
Can I just make another point here, going back to what Simon was talking about earlier, about these people not sharing the same morality that we have as Europeans, because essentially they've got no concept of the individual, their idea of the individual isn't as developed as us, what we have in Europe and in the West.
Another point, which I can bring up at this point, is, you know, another thing that's been neglected besides environmentalism, that if, you know, if when they say that we're all equal, you know, that a scientist is equal, is a white scientist who works and advances knowledge is equal to a Negro. You're not just elevating the Negro, you're actually deeply insulting us. You know, it's absolutely deeply offensive to us to say that we're the same, we're equal to this, you know, to this, you know, jungle bunny, basically.
Okay, Jez.
Yeah, I've got 4 points, actually. Ursula Haverbeck's organisation, before the local council closed down her sort of her building where she had these big meetings and weekend conferences, they often had Schumacher, author of Small is Beautiful, come to speak. As for free water, these mosques aren't just like a Christian church. They are a social centre, they are a library, they're a school, they're a job centre, and they're also a prayer hall. They have a canteen there, cafes.
Bank.
They use a lot of water. Mm. And if they can get away without paying, you know, metered water, they will do it. So that could be an explanation. Thirdly, recycling. In London, I had an interesting conversation with a bin man. And he says to me, I don't know why these white people bother recycling things into blue bags, into washing tins out and putting them in blue bags and black bags and green bags. And every day, thousands of immigrants move into this area and they just throw it all in the same place, you know, they just throw it in the park, whatever. These liberals, these people who think they're doing good by recycling, it's a drop in the ocean. Every year millions come in and they don't do it. And then finally, as for land ownership, go down to Kent and Sussex, the farms are getting bigger and bigger, there's hedgerows being destroyed, chemicals being used left, right and centre. The local people aren't allowed to go on the land, aren't allowed to cross the land, the children can't play on the land. And when you look at who owns this land, it's not British people, it's German Jews, it's Iranian Jews, it's Turkish Jews, it's Jews. That's all you need to know.
Well, as I said, the market at the moment for the really big land sales is China. And I don't think for a minute, because the Chinese have a completely different approach than the natural world to ourselves, a completely different philosophy, it's there to be exploited. Mm. And if it turns into a desert in 50 years' time, that's tough. We've had the profit and use out of it. Yeah. So we've got a future to look forward to there, haven't we?
Splendid. Gobi Desert.
There you go.
Okay, 10-minute break, and then we'll resume for our second speaker. Thank you.
Alternative to the anti-white system on RadioArea.com.